This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The Medrash says, Nochin kis achol me'oz, on the Pasuk in Tehillim, your throne has been prepared, has been ready since then. Omer Rabbi Brechia b'shem Rabbi Avu. Rabbi Brechia, in the name of Rabbi Avu, learns that Pasuk slightly differently and says, Afal pi shem e'ilom ato. Even though you, God, have always been, you've been in existence from all eternity, your throne has not been established, your throne has not been settled. And you were not known in your world until your children sang the Shiro at the splitting of the Red Sea after the Egyptians had been killed. That was the first time that you became known. So he says two things. The first one is, your throne was unsettled until that time, whatever that means. And the second is that you weren't known in the world until that time. And it doesn't say that what changed that was the fact that you split the Red Sea, that your name went all over the world and people heard about your splitting the Red Sea. It wasn't the act of splitting the Red Sea that established your throne and that gave you that fame. It was Ad She'omru Bonecho Shiro. It was when your children sang the Shiro. That was the turning point, so to say, Ki Beyochel, in the career of the Ribbono Shel Olam. When the Bnei Yisrael sang the Shiro, that's when things changed for God. And that's what that posuk means when it says, your throne has been ready, has been prepared, has been settled, me'oz, from the time that the Torah says, oz, it was at that moment that they sang the song of praise. Moshul, and the Medrash gives an example, this is its way. Lemelech she'oso milchomo, a king who carried out a war, conducted a war, v'nitzach, and he was successful, he was victorious. V'osu oisoi Augustus, and they made him a Caesar, they made him an even higher level than a king, than a prince. Omruloi, they said to him, ad sheloi osiso hamilchomo, ha'yiso melech. Until you actually went out to war, you were a king. You were a political leader, you were a social leader. Achshov, but now that you went out to war, that you've come back successfully, asinucho Augustus, we have made you into a Caesar, we have made you into a higher level. Mayesh kovid ben amelech lo Augustus, asks the Medrash, so what is the difference? If you're a king or you're a Caesar, in what way are you different? Explains the Medrash. Elo hamelech oimed al haluach v'Augustus yoshev. A king, when he stands on the platform, he stands. When the Caesar stands on the platform, he doesn't stand at all, he sits. That's the difference. Kach omru Yisrael, so Yisrael said, be'emes ad sheloi boroso ilomecho, until you created the world, from before the time you created the world, you existed. Umishe boroso yisoi atohu, and from the time you created the world, you were the one. Elo kebiyochel oimed, but it was as if you were standing. But when you stood by the sea and we sang the Shiro to you with Oz at that moment, at that moment your kingdom settled and you took your seat. You sat down for the first time. That was the way that the Medrash sees it. Interesting image. That there was a major change in the Ribbono Shel Olam status in the world, brought about by the singing of that Shir. And we're going to discuss this evening, what was this major change, and how did it come about, and what relevance has it got to us? Let me start off by summarizing very quickly what we said last night. On Oz Yoshir Moshe, where the Pasuk says, then, literally translated, then Moshe and the children of Israel will sing. And Rashi discusses why the then and the will, it's past tense and a future tense mixed together, explains Rashi, the Torah is focusing on a point between the past tense and the future. It was after the miracle that they made the decision that they would sing in the future. And it's the moment of that decision which this Pasuk is concentrating on. Oz, then, when the miracle had taken place, Yoshir says, explains Rashi, Olo beliboy sheyoshir. A decision, a conscious decision in his mind was made, sheyoshir, that he would say the shiro, that he would sing. And that's the moment that changes Hashem's career. As the Medrash says, it's Oz, it's the moment of Oz, Nochon kisacho me Oz, your throne was settled from Oz, from that moment when Bnei Israel decided to sing the shiur. We discussed last night what was unique about this miracle over and above previous miracles or subsequent miracles. Why was it this miracle more than any that caused them to launch into song? And we said because it resolved an apparent absurdity for them and gave them a sense of meaning of life. All the other miracles were caused by somebody being in trouble. Somebody was in trouble, there was no way out except a miraculous way out, and Hashem found a miraculous way out. And so when Avraham found himself in the furnace, in the fiery furnace, Hashem found a way out for him. And with Noach and with whoever you want to look at, Yitzchok, Yaakov, each one of them, they're in a moment of trouble, Hashem finds a miraculous way out for them. The difference here was that the miracle was not created to get them out of trouble. It's not that Bnei Israel got into trouble and Hashem had to get them out of trouble with a miracle. The big question that faced Bnei Israel at that moment when they stood with the sea in front of them and the Egyptians, the Mitzrim, gathering their forces behind them, the big question that faced Bnei Israel was, why are we here in the first place? Why didn't Hashem take us back the same way we came? When Yaakov came to Egypt, he didn't have to cross any seas. Nobody had to split any seas. He just walked. He crossed over that narrow area where the Suez Canal is today, where there was no reason to pass through any water at all. So why didn't we go back the same way? So the question, the absurd question that kept on bothering them was, why did Hashem do this to us? Had Hashem lost his way? Doesn't he know how to get us out of here? He's leading us from Mitzrayim to Eretz Israel. He's punished the Egyptians. They finally agreed to let us go. He knows that Paro is likely to change his mind, and in fact just does change his mind. What way does he lead us? Against the sea. What's the big idea? So it's not that they got into trouble and they needed a miracle to save them. When they saw the Egyptians drowning in the sea, they realized that they were led that way. They were put into trouble in order to give God the opportunity to perform the miracle. The miracle was the cause. Their trouble was the means, rather than the other way around. Previously, whenever they had a miracle, they got into trouble and that was the cause. And the miracle was the means. How do they get out of trouble? By means of the miracle. This one was a reverse situation. The miracle was the cause. In order that God should be able to perform the miracle, He put them into an absurd situation where they would need that miracle. And when they realized that, they realized more than that. They realized that was the whole purpose of life. That we are only here to glorify the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that Hashem puts us into situations in order to give us the opportunities for Kiddush Shem Shamayim. The Ribbono Shel Olam puts us into positions, into situations to afford us the opportunity to glorify His name. That's all. Everything revolves around that. And that perception, that magical moment of understanding the entire meaning of existence, brings Moshe to sing the shiur. Let's look at that concept a little further. That our whole function is to glorify Hashem's name. The Rabbeinu Yoino says, in Shari Tshuva Shari Shlishi Simon Kufnun Ches, V'ato and now, Amoid V'hisboinein, stand and complicate and contemplate. Amoid, stop a while. And just think. Goydel Chiyuveinu L'kadesh Es Hashem. Just think how great is our obligation to sanctify Hashem's name. Ki ikar ma shekidshonu Hashem yisborach b'tiroso uvemitzvosof. Because the reason for which Hashem sanctified us with Torah and mitzvahs. So Rabbeinu Yehuda is now facing the critical question. Why did God give us the Torah? Why did God give us the mitzvahs? The principal reason, and the reason that Hivdilonu lihiyos lo ilam, the reason that He separated us to be a nation to Him, kedei lekadshoi uleyiro mimenu, is so that we can perform Kiddush Hashem. That is our duty. That is our only duty. And everything else is for that purpose. We have no other purpose. We have no other duty. Our purpose is not to fight wars, and our purpose is not to discover nuclear physics, and our purpose is to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. That's it. And he goes on to explain, so why do we need the whole Torah? Why do we need all the other mitzvahs? And Hashem should have given us one mitzvah. Be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. That's the only mitzvah we need. Explains the Shaarei Tshuva. Because our function is to serve, to sanctify Hashem, ra'ui shiyehiyeh makdishov kedoshim. It is proper that those who sanctify Him should be sanctified themselves, should be holy. B'shegam hakelim she'ovdim bohem lefnei Hashem yizborach tzrichim liyos kodesh. The utensils used in the Beis HaMikdosh have to be holy. It's not sufficient that they're performing holy duties. Because they're performing holy duties, the utensil needs to have Kedusha. And the reason that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us all the Torah and all the mitzvahs is to purify and sanctify us so that we can be fitting Kalim to sanctify His name, to perform Kiddush Hashem. That's the purpose of the whole thing. Nothing more, nothing less. It's amazingly simple, and it's absolutely astounding in how far-reaching it is. That the purpose of Jewish existence is only one thing, and that is Lekadesh Shem Shemayim. And that means every situation in which we find ourselves, as I said last night, needs the question to be asked, how can I use this opportunity to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim? That's the only question that has to be asked. There's I was reading a work of a young man. I don't think he even has a university education. He was down and out as a young boy, just after school in the United States, and he decided to go into training business people and so on. And he developed an astounding understanding of psychology. And as I say, I don't think he studied it. I think from reading, from speaking to people and understanding people. One of the points he makes is that one of the differences between successful and unsuccessful people, he says, is the questions that you ask. Because if you ask yourself a question and you're persistent, you're determined to find out the answer, you will find the answer. That's in accordance with Chazal, that's quite right. Sheilas chochem chatzi tshuva. Once a chochem has asked a question, that's already half the answer. Once the question is formulated, he says, you will find an answer. Your mind will be working subconsciously. You will find answers. And the answer is determined by the kind of question you've posed. And so the critical thing is how you formulate the question. And he gives examples. He says, so for example, if a person asks himself, why did this happen to me? Why did such a terrible thing happen to me? The answer is going to have to be because you're a naughty boy. You're asking for that answer. That's what your question is saying. Why did such a bad thing happen to me? What you're asking is, tell me why I'm so bad. And he says, if you think long enough, you'll figure out why you're so bad. And if you do that often enough, you'll convince yourself that you're totally bad, useless and worthless, and that's why God punishes you ceaselessly. And that's the end of it. And you're finished then as a person. If you just phrase the question a little bit differently, what opportunity does this pose for me? How can I use this to my best advantage? You're also asking a question. And if you ask it with the same determination, you'll find an answer too. It will be a different answer. It will be an answer that will enable you to move forward instead of paralyzing yourself. That's a very perceptive analysis. That we can't control the answers, but we can control the questions. The answers aren't for us to give, but the questions are for us to formulate. And what we work out from this Rabbeinu Yonah is that there's really only one question to ask yourself each time something happens. And that is, how can I turn this into a Kiddush Hashem? That's all. That's the only relevant question. Not why is it happening to me, and who am I, and what's the purpose, and where am I going, and will there be a South Africa tomorrow, or won't there be a South Africa tomorrow? We sit and we burden ourselves with all these questions that all need answers. And we walk around with these perplexed faces with dozens of questions that need to be answered. There's only one question that needs to be implanted clearly in our mind and fired into our brains and be made and to be made aware of in us at all times. And that is, Rabbeinu Yonah says, Ki ikar ma shekidoshonu Hashem Yisborach b'tzoyrosu uv'mitzvosov v'idilonu l'yoslom. The reason we were given the Torah, the reason I am a Jew, is kedei lekadshoy, is to sanctify God's name. How do I do it in this circumstance? That's the only relevant question. Nothing else is relevant. Everything else fits into place if one has that in one's mind clearly. Now, Rabbeinu Yonah says a little bit earlier in his sefer, in Siman Kuf Memches, he tells us how. Ki hadover yadua, for it is well known. Ki midarkei kiddush Hashem yisborach. How do you do it? How do you sanctify Hashem? What is the method? To communicate with every movement of your lips. And every expression of your eye. And with every body movement. And every movement of your hands. To communicate with that. Let's stop there for a moment. There are lots of limudim one can get from all sorts of funny places in the world. But one of the things, while we were overseas, I took one of my children to the film studios, where one can learn a lot of things. You don't learn much about films. They just destroy any illusions you might have ever had about them. But you learn a lot about life. And one of the things you learn is if you happen to be fortunate enough to see somebody producing, and you see the attention to the detail given to every movement, every flicker of the eyelid, every tiny movement of a little finger, every movement of any facial muscle, and how they will refilm and refilm and refilm again and again because that smile wasn't quite right. That eyebrow was a little too high. Let's just do it again. It's not giving the right message. It's not quite right. And again, and again, and again. And then they go into the film studio, of course, where they start. They'll take the eyebrow from the one picture and the mouth from the other picture and put the two together. Then they make already something which never even existed. But be that as it may, the importance that is given to having the precision, the absolute precision of expression, they understand what can be expressed with a movement of a facial muscle, with a casual slight movement of a finger or a hand, with body posture, until they get it right. And Rabbeinu Yonah says here, Ki adover yodua ki midarche kiddush Hashem yisborach lohidia, to communicate bechol mivtos v'sayim, with every single movement of the lips. Not just sometimes, not just when you're in shul, not just when you're davening, bechol mivtos v'sayim, every single movement of your lips. Uvechol asher yirmezu enayim, and every movement of the eye, 24 hours a day. Whenever you move an eyelid, or an eyebrow, or an eyelash, anything in the eye, any movement in the eye, you're communicating. Uvechol hanhogo, and any action. Ufeil yodayim, any movement of the hand, anyone, at any time, all day, every day. What are you meant to communicate? Now you're in the movies, you're being produced. And the producer is saying to you, but you're not communicating right. That flick of the eye was wrong. That smile doesn't say it quite right. That movement of the hand doesn't say it quite right. What is the message we're meant to be communicating 24 hours a day? Ki yesoid l'nefesh ha'odom. You have to communicate that the principle, the foundation of the human soul, utzvi edyoy, and its most glorious decoration, v'hatoiv, and the absolute good, v'ho'ikor, and the principle, v'ha'to'eles, and the most useful, v'ha'yokor, and the most precious, asher boy, that exists in it, is avodas Hashem yisborach v'yiroso v'seiroso. Avodas Hashem, service of God, the fear of Him, and His Torah. That's what you need to be communicating 24 hours a day. That's what Kiddush Hashem is. It's unbelievable. Absolutely amazing. As I've often said in the Mitzvah Shabbos Shirim, we have to understand Torah as it really is meant to be. We've got to look at the ideals. And it's no good saying to ourselves, but that's just, it's totally unrealistic, it's so far beyond us, it's no good making us depressed or anything like that at all. One needs to become enthused by what the Torah expects of a human being. What a Torah life means, at least have a picture in your mind of what a Torah Jew is meant to be. At least that. It's not an easy picture to gain because you don't see it very often. It's very seldom, there are very few people that are living like this, where one can actually see it. Occasionally one sees it. And then one has to know about it in order to recognize it, otherwise you don't even notice it. One has to understand what's happening. But at least to conjure up in one's mind a picture of what a frum Jew is supposed to be. So at least one uses the words a little bit carefully when you talk about so-and-so as a Yorei Shamayim, or so-and-so as frum, or so-and-so as a Talmid Chochem, or whatever it is. One has to use the words rather carefully when you understand what the Torah wants of us. And of us, it means of us too. And even though we might not in one step be able to get all the way there, at least we need to be conscious of the direction we need to be taking. We need to be able to see the beacon on the horizon. And this is the beacon. Rabbeinu Yonah said, the purpose of life is Kiddush Hashem. And here he defines Kiddush Hashem. Kiddush Hashem is the constant 24-hour-a-day communication with every limb of one's body and every word that one utters and every movement of one's face. The constant communication that there is nothing more beautiful, more important, more fundamental and more useful than serving the Ribbono Shel Olam, fearing Him and His Torah. That's it. K'mo she'kosuv, as it says in Koheles, and here Rabbeinu Yonah gives the pshat, the meaning, in those last words in Koheles. Ki zeh kol ha'odo. Because that is all of man. That's what that means. When the Koheles says at the end of it, Soif dover ha'kol nishma, listen, what's it all about? Es ha'alokim yorei, ves mitzvos of shomer, fear God, observe His mitzvahs. Ki zeh kol ha'odo. All of man must be dedicated to that. That means your nose and your eyes and your mouth and your hands and your feet, everything you do at all times, zeh kol adam, that's all that man is all about, is that. That's Kiddush Hashem. And he goes on, v'acharei asher hisbarer she'akol boro Hashem yisborach lichvodoy. And once you have understood with clarity that everything Hashem created for His own kovod, chayev ha'odom losim liboy becholes, a person has to apply his mind at all times, 24 hours a day, 365 and a quarter days a year, all the time, lechabed es Hashem, to honor Hashem, ulekadshoi, and to sanctify Him, bechol devorov, in everything a person does, ularoi memoi, and to exalt Him, lohidoisloi, to thank Him, ulevorchoi tomid, and to bless Him at all times. And when he's amongst people, yisboinen bino, he should apply his mind, v'yadakdek, and he should be meticulous, v'yashgiach, and he should watch himself, v'chol moitzis fosov, in the way he expresses every word that he utters, l'kadeshes Hashem b'dvorov, to sanctify Hashem with his words, u'ledaber b'shvach avidosoi, u'tehilas yirosoi, and to talk positively about the service of Hashem, and the praiseworthiness of his, of fearing Him, ulashabeach avodov, to praise the servants of Hashem, and so on. That's what it's all about. That's what life is all about, according to Rabbeinu Yonah, according to the Torah. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu and Bnei Yisrael grasped with such clarity as they stood there. We were standing here a few hours, they said to themselves, asking why? Why did God do this? What we've learned is that that was the wrong question to be asked. The question to be asked was simply, how can we turn this into a Kiddush Hashem? And Hashem showed us how. The whole thing was designed to be a spectacular manifestation of the glorification of God's name. And that's the mission of the Jewish people, and that's the mission of each individual Jew. To design situations, to find himself in situations constantly where he can be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim. And you need to know in your own lives that any situation in which you find yourself, if it's not a situation into which you've put yourself, if you've put yourself into the situation, then you figure out what it's all about. But if Hashem has put you into a situation, you can know for sure that there is one purpose in it, and that is Lekadesh Shem Shamayim. All you have to do is figure out the most effective way to do it. How can I take this situation, how can I take this circumstance, and with my unique blend of personality in this unique situation, sanctify God's name in a unique and a special way. That's what we need to be asking ourselves. That's all that's important. And we ask ourselves that when we stand and we dive into the Ribbono Shel Olam. We ask ourselves that when we sit down to a meal. We ask ourselves that when we go out to work. We ask ourselves that when we're relating to the other members of our family, to society, when we're reading, learning, having leisure, whatever it is that we're doing. At all times we need to be asking ourselves, how can I turn this into a Kiddush Hashem? What does all this mean in terms of the Medrash with which we started? The Medrash says, Afal pi shema'ilo mato, loynis yashev kisocha v'loynedato b'ilomecho, od she'omrub, ad she'omrub anecho shiru. Even though you've always existed, your throne has not been settled, and you have not been known in the world, until your children sang the shiru. What is shiru? There's communication and there's communication. Let me give you again, when I travel I find that opportunity to notice all sorts of things that perhaps in the normal routine of life one doesn't notice. In the United States they've developed certain formulas. They're very good at working out formulas. When they find out something that works, they apply it very, very widely. And they found certain formulas for many things in business particularly. I'll give you a very simple example that they're using very effectively all over now. When you phone up nearly any American company, the way the receptionist answers the phone is virtually standard. It's the same, no matter where in America you phone, whatever company you phone, it's virtually standard because they found a formula that works. And it runs something like this. Let me first show you the contrast. If you phone a South African company or a British company, you'll be lucky, firstly, if they answer the phone altogether. When they finally, after 25 rings, they finally pick up the phone, you get the feeling that she's been disturbed. She was doing something more important and your phone call interrupted her. You get that feeling even if she doesn't mean it. And if you're lucky, if she's really efficient, she'll answer something like, this is XYZ company, good afternoon, or whatever it is. Or she might give the telephone number. That's if you've got a good one. In America, the standard one will be, hello, this is Mary, what can we do to help you? She doesn't tell you what company you phoned, you know what company you phoned. And if you don't, firstly, the phone's there, you usually get through to the right number, unlike other countries. So there's no reason for her to tell you what number you phoned. I suppose here it's important. The first thing is tell them what number they've gotten through to, because if it happens to be the same number they dialed, that's merely coincidental and they should know about it. But in the United States, it doesn't work like that. Normally, you dial a number. That's the number you get through to. So there's no surprise that you got here. When you finally, you know, you dial Anglo-American and she says Anglo-American here, you say, gee, first time. That's wonderful. It's quite amazing. In America, it's not like that. You dial and you expect to get through, and you do get through. So she doesn't tell you what company you've called. And she doesn't tell you what telephone number she's called. And she doesn't even say good morning or good afternoon. She tells you her name. And she asks how she can help you, which enables you to launch straight into what you need to ask her, in a way which makes you feel that she's there to help you, and she answers the phone within 4 or 5 rings. That's her job. She has to do that, and that's the formula. If you want the business to be successful, there's certain things you have to do. This is one of them, a very small thing, but very important. The phone has to be answered within 5 rings. It has to be answered pleasantly, and the way it has to be answered is, and there's no deviation tolerated. Hello, I'm Mary, if her name is Mary. If her name is something else, she's allowed to use her other name. It doesn't have to, they don't all say Mary. But she'll say, hello, I'm Mary, or she'll run and say, this is Mary speaking, how can we help you? That's the way it is. It makes you feel good. Now, why don't they just computerize that? Because they're doing that very sophisticatedly as well, which happens very often. You'll phone many numbers for information, and you'll get an answer phone, also a very polite one, and it'll then start. If you want this, press number 1. If you want this, press number 2. If you want this, press number 3. And you press number 3. Then it starts again. If you want this, press number 1. Then it gives you a whole lot of other options. And finally you get your way through, and the truth is much quicker than you would with a human receptionist. Because you don't have to explain everything over and over again each time they put you through to somebody else. You don't have to explain at all. She reads out a list of options, one of which inevitably includes what you're looking for, and by pressing the right key you eventually get to exactly the right recorded machine, which gives you the information you want without having to ask for it. Those are two different kinds of ways that the telephone is handled. Which one leaves you more wanting to do business with a company? The first or the second one? The first. Even though the second one might have been more efficient. because there's human contact in the fist. That's the difference between shiro and between talking. Communication, straight one-dimensional communication. A machine can do that. You can have computer-generated answers. One of the most frustrating ones there is when you phone directory inquiries and a real human being answers you and says, yes, so-and-so speaking, or even the operator, Mary speaking, how can I help you? I would like the name of Mr. Yankel Schmerl, who lives in Alaska. I would like the number, the telephone number, and the address, please. She says, sure, just a moment. And then a few seconds later, a computer starts reading it out to you.
1-6-3-2.
And then you put down the phone. You look at this thing. There's nobody to say thank you to. You didn't have a chance to say thank you to her and goodbye. All of a sudden, in the middle of it, the computer starts speaking to you. And when it's finished, you just put it down. It leaves you feeling very cold. It leaves you feeling funny. There's a difference between transferring information and communicating. Transferring information is merely factual. Communicating is emotional. Communicating changes the way the other person feels. Transference of information does not change the way another person feels. It only gives him more information. And that's why if you've got a good receptionist, she is capable of making the person who is phoned in want to speak to you. She is capable of making the person who's phoned in want to do business with you. And she's also capable, by the way, of doing exactly the reverse. Making the person who's phoned in never want to do business with you again. She can affect the but with every single call she does affect the emotions, the feelings of the person who's phoned in, because that's communication. What is the difference between the computer communicating, a computer-generated voice, and a human voice? There are many differences, but one of the simple ones is shiro. That the computer-generated voice is monotonous in the literal sense of the word. It doesn't vary. The shiro is responsive. The person is responding to you. The way you talk to her, that's the way she'll respond to you. And a relationship is actually set up. There is a dynamic. Something's happening. When you get another person on the phone, and you talk to him, and he talks to you, and there's some form of communication, you're affecting the way you're feeling about one another. That's what shiro does. Shiro changes feelings. And of course, the extreme example of shiro, if you remove all information transmittance from shiro, you're left with music, with non-verbal music. That's a form of communication, but it's not transferring any information. It's communication without the transfer of any information whatever. That's music. On the other extreme, you've got a computer-generated voice, which transmits information without any emotion at all. And then you've got shiro, which is in the middle, where you have words, but those words are sung. Those words are not said. Now, all of language is sung, it's not said. The way we talk, there's expression, we pause, there's drama, we raise our voices, we lower our voices. There's meant to be song in the way we speak. And if there is song in the way we speak, we can change other people's feelings. If there is no song in the way we speak, we cannot change other people's feelings. You see all the films that show American lawyers in court working with a jury, which is very interesting to watch them. And in real life, they're just like that. They're not transferring information to the jury. The jury is not going to make its decision on the basis of information. They've got to change the jury's feelings. So if you have an advocate who goes to the appeal court and is talking to five judges who've spent all their lives in law, and they're arguing a subtle point of law, it's very boring. And it's very dry, and the one side gives his story, and the other side gives his story, and the judge asks a few questions, and they answer, and they debate backwards and forwards. It's all monotonous. But you look at an American courtroom with a jury, it's dramatic. Why must one be dramatic and was one monotonous? Because in the one there is only a transfer of information, and on the basis of that information, a rational decision will be made. And in the other case, there's a change of feeling that has to take place. They have to feel differently. Each advocate is trying to make the jury feel differently about their client. And what we need to understand is that in all forms of human communication, that is required. In all forms of human communication, the way you feel determines a great deal of what you decide to do. And the success of communication is not only in the transfer of the information. The success of the communication is in how effectively you've managed to change the other person's feeling. But there's something else to it. And that is, there is a tremendous thrill when a successful communication has taken place. When a lawyer has won a case. But not just out of an argument on a technicality. When he's really had to swing a judge or swing a jury and he's succeeded. He's on a high afterwards. It's as if he's on drugs. When a salesman has completed a really difficult deal. He's persuaded somebody to invest. He's persuaded somebody to buy. He's on a high. When a teacher has put over a difficult idea and the class has responded, he's on a high or she's on a high. What is that? That is the highest form of a feeling of potency, of a feeling of relevance. I have been able to change the way another person is feeling. That's incredibly important. Incredibly important. Actors have it with an audience. Sportsmen have it with an audience. That's why they need audiences. The audience affects them when they feel that they are getting through to the audience. That changes their whole caliber of acting. Their whole level of expression improves. And the two feed on each other. As they improve, the audience responds more. As the audience responds more, they improve more. What is happening? What is the dynamic? They are changing the way people are feeling. And that's terribly important. That's terribly valuable. And one feels that value when you're able to change the way people feel. One feels it. Now, people pay a lot of money to feel good. People pay a lot of money. I give the example in some of the business ethics talks. If you take a person who's traveling to a wealthy person, is going to London tonight. He's going to be in an aeroplane for less than 12 hours. You can get a ticket to London for under 2,000 Rand. But the first class seats are pretty well taken up. A first class seat costs nearly 10,000 Rand. That means he's paying an additional 7,500 Rand for the first class seat. Now if you come to him afterwards, you say, look, you're a businessman. 7,500 Rand for what? For some good meals. Let's say 500 Rand for the meals. That's what the meals are worth. What else are you paid for? For the big chair. For 7,000 Rand, you could buy a whole lounge suite and keep it forever. Not one chair and have it only for one night. So for 2,500 Rand, you can get to London. Spend 500 Rand, take your own food. Go to the best restaurant in Johannesburg and ask them to pack you some food. Spend 500 Rand on it. Spend 1,000 Rand. Really treat yourself. Tell them to put in the best they've got for 1,000 Rand, one dinner. So it's now 3,500 Rand. Take the balance and buy yourself a leather lounge suite. Isn't that better business than sitting in a first class seat? And you're worried that you'll be tired because you won't have such a good night? Usually the people who spend that money on their first class seats, they don't sleep. That's a bit of a waste of money to sleep when you spend all that money. They drink and they talk to their friends and they don't sleep. So it's not because you're going to feel more fresh when you get to your destination. The people at the back of the plane are fast asleep because there's nothing else to do except watch a boring movie. And the people in the front of the plane, they're using their money. They're not sleeping. So that's not the reason. So for 2,500 Rand, for 2,000 Rand, you've got the fare. For another 1,000 Rand, you've got the best meal that anybody could possibly have. That's 3,000 Rand. And you've got another 7,000 Rand to spend on a leather lounge suite. Surely that makes more sense than buying the first class seat. So what does he spend 7,000 Rand on? Not on the seat. And not on the food. He spends 7,000 Rand to feel good. Nothing else. And people will do that. People will do it. And we all do it. When somebody goes to a restaurant for dinner, what does it cost them at a restaurant? Here, the restaurants are still cheap. You go overseas, you go into a restaurant, it'll cost you 300 Rand. Two people having an ordinary sort of dinner, you'll pay 300 Rand for it. When they have a special dinner, you'll pay 400 Rand for it. More, 500 Rand. How much is the food worth? If you went out and bought the food, how much is the food worth that you've just paid 500 Rand for? The food might be worth 50 Rand. You have a bottle of wine with it, the food might be worth 70 Rand. Let's say some real specials again, 100 Rand. So what are you paying the other 400 Rand for? To feel good. That's all. How are they marking cinemas when you can get every film on video? How are they marketing? How are they getting people to go out of their houses and to spend more money to sit in somebody else's place in a whole row of people? With your eyes glued, you can't turn it off, you can't stop, you can't do anything. You've got to sit there, there's nothing that you can do. How are they marketing that? It feels better. The sensation is better. People are willing to pay a lot of money to feel good. And when a human being develops the capacity to affect the feelings of others, he's a very potent human being. And he feels very good about that too. And that might sound a little manipulative. But what we learn over here is that that's part of the Metzius. That's the way that Ribbono Shel Olam works too. Says the Medrash, Me'olam Ato. You've existed forever. We've all known about the Ribbono Shel Olam. Avraham discovered God. Yitzchok knew about God. Adam knew about God. Mankind has always known about God. Always. You've been there. In the Yeshiva Shem Ve'ever, your word has been studied. The Torah has been studied. And later on, throughout Avraham, Yitzchok, Yaakov, your Torah was studied, your words were studied. But lo nisyashiv kisocho, you couldn't sit down, your job wasn't over, lo nidata be'olamecho, you weren't truly known. Until when? Ad she'omru vonecho shiro. When they broke into song, that's when you know. When you see, anybody who's taught knows what it is. Anybody who's addressed an audience knows what it is. You're passing over information. And you're watching your audience. And they're attentive. And you're on and on. And you know you haven't got through. All of a sudden, in one person's face, you see an expression on his face. You see a sparkle in his eye. Just a moment. And you know you've got through. That's the moment you know. Not before then. And even if you test them afterwards and they give you back 100% correct answers, until you've spotted that glimmer in the eye, until you've spotted that change of facial expression, you haven't got through. Because until that time, all you've done is you've transferred information. At the time you notice that glimmer in the eye, that change of expression, you know you've changed, you've affected the person's feelings. Once you've affected the person's feelings, everything else flows. That's the point at which you know you're successful. And that happens in any communication. It happens in a one-to-one communication just the same. That's one of the difficulties with telephonic communication. That's why we find telephonic communication uncomfortable. Because we don't have that. You don't know quite when you've got through and whether you're getting through. And you don't have the thrill of feedback. You don't have the thrill of seeing the person smile when you say something that he appreciates. You don't have the thrill of watching the person looking at you. Or that are void of feedback. We're isolating ourselves and insulating ourselves more and more from feedback. And we can't function without feedback. We can't function in vacuums. Those are the old experiments they've done with newborn babies where they've deprived the babies of feedback. They put the babies into machines where the babies have been fed with everything they need to be fed with, given drink, whatever they need to be drink. Being kept at the right temperatures, nappies changed, everything fine. Only one thing they've deprived them of, and that's human contact. And the babies have shown exactly the same symptoms as babies who deprive the food and drink. They show the same symptoms of malnutrition. And that applies not only to babies, it applies to everybody. If we don't have that human contact, if we aren't able to get the feedback, if we aren't able to feel the effect that we're having on others, we shrivel up. We become a quarter of our size in terms of personality. We cease to be effective and our whole personality suffers as a result of that. And again, that sounds odd and it sounds pathetic. But what do we see? That until Omru Vonecho Shiro, until they broke into song, that wasn't considered being effective. The way Avraham knew you, Hashem, that wasn't it yet. The way Yitzchok knew you, the way Yaakov knew you, the way the world knew you through them, that wasn't enough yet. Until they break into song, shiro, which is emotional, which has music to it, then you know you've gotten through to the world. Now they know who you are. Now your communication has been successful. And finally, what happens when you're communicating successfully? When you're communicating successfully, you feel secure. Because there's nothing more powerful than communicating, than the ability to communicate successfully. And remember, I said in a Friday night Rosh towards the end of last year, communication is successful only when the other person has got the message. Very often you hear somebody saying, but I told him 100 times. It's irrelevant how many times you told him. If he didn't hear you, you have not communicated. And hearing doesn't mean that it penetrated his ear. Hearing means shiro, a change in his facial expression. When you see a change in the facial expression of the person you're talking to, then you know you've gotten through. There are certain people whose facial expression never changes. There are people, you could drop an atom bomb in front of them and their facial expression wouldn't change. Just keep away from such people. Just, they don't do you any good because you don't get any feedback from them. Just ignore them, let them go their own way. There are such people. Nothing will change them. They don't laugh if you tell them a joke. They don't concentrate if you tell them something. Nothing. They just have the same facial expression. That doesn't do good to anybody. But they somehow manage to get through life. The only time you've communicated successfully is when you've created a response in the other person. Something visual. The person does something. He expresses what you've told him. Whether it's through an action, or it's just through a smile, or through a concentration, or through a change in the way he's looking. The tiniest little thing, as Rabbeinu Yonah said, it might just be through the lifting of an eyebrow, or the flick of an eyelid, that you see you've had effect. He's got the communication. Until that time, you haven't communicated. And until there's shira, until Bnei Yisrael broke out into song, says Rabbi Brechia b'shem Rabbi Avu, Hashem hasn't communicated properly. But when you have communicated properly and the other person responds, you feel security. That's what love is. Love is a response to another person's communication. When you feel that you are valued, when you feel you are appreciated for what you've done, for what you've put in, you feel loved. When you don't feel that, you don't feel loved. And when a person feels loved or he feels needed, he feels secure. And the difference between standing and sitting is the difference between being secure and being insecure. A person stands when he still has to do something. He stands when he's afraid. He stands if he has to defend himself. A person who's not worried about being attacked sits down. A person who's not worried about his situation, a person who's feeling secure, he sits down, he takes a seat. And that's why when we invite a person, if you want to make a person feel at ease when he comes into your office, you say, please have a seat. If you want him to feel on spielkes, you don't tell him to have a seat. You leave him standing. And you talk to him there and he feels very insecure, very worried. What's going on here? What's the difference? Because he's standing. You haven't invited him to sit. Says Rabbi Brechi, b'shem Rabbi Avul, the Rebbeinu Shlom Kibyochel was standing. All that time he didn't feel secure. Because he didn't ignite in people a sense of song. He didn't bring people to Shiro. He brought them to learning Torah, to talking about Torah, to teaching Torah. He had the most wonderful people. He had an Avraham Avinu, he had a Yitzchok, he had a Yaakov. Unbelievable dedication to him. But all that time Hashem is standing, he's not sitting. Because the world hasn't started singing yet. Comes the Shiro and the world starts singing. The Ribbono Shel'olam sit down. Now I've got through to them. Now I've communicated with them. And so it is in all that we do. We have a need, as Rabbeinu Yonah says, to communicate. And to communicate with every movement of every part of ourselves. And what are we meant to communicate? We're meant to communicate the Bechol Miftos Fasayim of Bechol Asheir Mizuneinayim of Bechol Hanhogu Ofer Yodayim. Every movement of every part of our body. That the most fundamental aspect of our souls, of our spiritual existence, that our most glorious decoration, that the true goodness, the fundamental principle and the most useful and precious of all that we have is Avodas Hashem Yisborach V'Yirosoi V'Soirosoi. But we can only do that when we have only been successful in that when not only when we are singing ourselves, but when we get other people to sing along with us. When we're able to communicate that and we see in people's face a feeling of, gee, this is unbelievable, this is incredible. If this is the Torah, this is wonderful. And we see a sense of song being communicated to other people, then we know that we have made some kind of progress. Then we know that we have achieved some kind of success in the fulfillment of our purpose, the purpose to be Mekadesh Shem Shomayim, the purpose that with every movement of every limb of ours, and every expression of our mouths and our faces to sanctify the Ribbono Shel Olam's name with Kiddush Hashem.